thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 26 for the 7th of May, 2008. Free for all. I'm Dan Cohen. Welcome back to another episode of Digital Campus. We're lucky to have Mills back on the program. Hi, Mills. Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hey, how are you?
And Tom Scheinfeld, of course. Hi, Tom.
Hi, guys.
And we've got some interesting news stories from the week, and of course we're wrapping up the semester, and Mills, you're finishing up grading, is that right?
No, the grading tsunami has just crashed over my desk, and so now I'm going to spend the next week grading.
Oh, goodness. Well, good luck with that. I guess we'll keep the podcast short today. The first story we wanted to talk about was very much a campus story, and one that we haven't talked about in a while, but certainly something that we have covered on prior Digital Campus podcasts, and that is that the Recording Institute RIA stand for again? Recording Industry Association of America, of course, which has been known in the past to send out tersely worded emails to CIOs and others on campus about the file trading that goes on, music file trading. And evidently, it looks like they've really stepped up their efforts to crack down once again on piracy, music piracy, on campuses. We haven't talked about this in a while. Mills, Tom, is it your sense that, I mean, is this just, they've gotten more aggressive because they think there's more piracy? Is this something new? Has the landscape changed in the past year since we started discussing this on the podcast? And do you think file trading is up, down, about the same?
I think from what I can tell, and sort of from what I just the sense I get on campus and what little I hear from students, I think it's probably about the same. I think this is possibly the RIAA feeling increasingly desperate. They've exhausted, I think, a lot of their legal challenges and legal means for stopping this, and going after individual students has gotten them a ton of bad press. And so maybe now they're targeting, and it seems like this is true also on the legislative side as well as the more retail side. They're targeting the universities themselves rather than the students at the universities. So here we see the RIAA sending more and more notices to university IT departments trying to get IT departments to cooperate in cracking down on file sharing. In the House, we saw RIAA lobbyists push through a bill recently that would target universities who allow their students to file share or who don't crack down sufficiently on their students. It would target them with penalties to their student loan funds. And so maybe it just represents a change in tactics for the RIAA. But I don't know if it reflects any kind of increase or decrease in student file sharing.
Yeah, I mean, GW, George Washington University, just down the road from us, they usually receive, according to the Chronicle of Higher Ed, 5 to 10 notices per week from the RIAA. And last week alone, they received 123 notices. Could be software that's detecting this better. Mills, what are your thoughts on this?
My thoughts are that I guess if I were them, I would probably be doing it this way because, as you said, the targeting of individual students has just garnered them a lot of bad press. The targeting of the platforms like Kazaa and I can't even think of what was the original one. I've already forgotten now.
Napster.
Okay. Napster. See, it's been so long. You know, the targeting of those organizations hasn't really worked. It hasn't prevented anything in terms of file sharing. And so now they're going after what is, I have to say, a weaker link in the chain, because universities are so lawsuit averse that just the threat of a lawsuit is often enough to make universities knuckle under. And I'm not saying that universities should, you know, facilitate and allow lots of file sharing. But I do think that, you know, especially universities like ours, which is incredibly lawsuit averse, in part because we have no endowment to speak of and so can't afford expensive lawyers to defend ourselves. So if I were the RIAA, I would be going after places like George Mason. I probably would give Princeton and Stanford and Harvard a pass because they might actually defend themselves in court.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like you know, I mean, this has been going on for a while, and, you know, I think it probably had some effect, but I just think this generation is probably lost to the RIAA. I mean, you know, I think people under 25, they just got used to, between the Napster years and, you know, today, which is, you know, it's now been a significant number of years. I think the acquisition of music in a free model, in a legal, but free and easy model. It just, you know, I think, you know, we're buying music, but I think this younger generation has just gotten used to getting music through all these different ways. I mean, I think they're not using something like Napster anymore, but there are just so many ways to trade files on the internet that I could believe that probably after, you know, some decline in file trading after the initial lawsuits went out, I think people just feel like now there are just so many ways to get free music that they're probably doing it again. And I'll bet you the RIAA has some numbers backing this up and is getting worried about that sort of generational problem that this whole generation's come up with, you know, the notion that music is something you get for free and they're going to find any way to do it.
Well, you have to say, though, that it was, in the end, it's the recording industry are somewhat at fault here. I think that they really – it took them 10 years. It took them really about 10 years to provide a good selection of legal and reasonably priced options for downloading digital music from the internet. So now we have finally, after years and years, a mature outlet in iTunes, a good competitor in Amazon, and then some subscriptions, worthy subscription services like the new Napster and others, Rhapsody, and others. So, I mean, it took them really almost a good decade to get to provide consumers with what they were wanting, to provide a legal means for giving consumers what they wanted, and so in those intervening years, the students, who the early adopters, went elsewhere, and that was to the black market. So,
and then those early adopters told all their friends about how to do it, and you know, these are people with time on their hands. They can, you know, now, even though it's relatively inexpensive, and the Amazon service is really terrific. It's 89 cents a song. It's less than iTunes, and it's DRM free. I mean, you can put it on any device you want and as many devices as you want. But they're still willing to kind of go around that to get free music because they know how, they've learned how to do it really easily from all their friends.
And this is why, you know, I think Chris Anderson is completely right in saying that the problem with this particular issue of music sales is that it's an economic model that was created, what, in the 1920s, 1930s, whenever vinyl records started being mass marketed. You know, it's worn itself out. The new delivery systems for content are completely at odds with that model that worked so well for, you know, 60, 70, 80 years. And what the RIAA is doing is defending a model that's really over. And they just won't recognize that. And that instead they should be investing their resources as an association into developing new economic models where they can make a lot of money in this new economy instead of the economy that, you know, was great in the 1960s.
Yeah, right. I mean, I still think they've got this deer in the headlights way of looking at things. And I just, you know, I wonder about, you know, like Tom said, it's been 10 years really since Napster took off. It's amazing to think about that. But the fact that you have a whole decade to try to think about new models, you know, you've got students coming into colleges now who were, you know, were 8 when Napster was launched, and they've been used to, through their entire teens, you know, they've been used to stealing music, and they haven't experienced something really exciting from the RIAA's membership that's gotten them to look at this a different way. It's rather astonishing to think about. Another interesting story that caught our eye this past week was the University of Chicago Law School. I guess the professors there were getting a little sick of students in classes tapping away at their laptops. Boy, is this a feeling I know quite well from teaching. But they're now actually cutting off wireless and wired access in their classrooms at the University of Chicago Law School. Good idea? Bad idea? Boy, students, you know, they're bringing their laptops. They're clicking away. I assume they're not taking notes all the time professor's perspective. Surely there's other things going on. Is this the wave of the future?
I think they're really onto something here, and I think the next innovation that they need is these cerebellum implants that you can install into the human brain that as soon as somebody starts daydreaming in class, it gives them like 40 volts. You know, I think that's the answer is no one in my class is allowed to not pay attention. They must always pay attention at all times. Well, so give me those implants, you know. I'll put them right in my students' ears, and then they'll just get zapped every time they lose the thread of what I'm saying.
But, I mean, you don't think there's a distraction going on here, Mills? I mean, this is the box of utmost distraction. I mean,
yes, but that's their problem, not my problem. you know, I have exams. And if they want to pass my exams, if they want to do well on the papers that I assign, then maybe they want to pay attention. And, you know, if they want to get – in my classes, class participation is 25% of the grade in whichever class I teach. And so, you know, if they want to participate, they better be participating as opposed to doing whatever else they might be doing. And so, you know, over the years, I've gotten pretty good at noticing when somebody's eyes have glazed over in front of their laptop. And so what do? I ask them a question. So, Dan, what do you think about that? And then Dan looks up from his laptop and says, what? His class participation grade just went down. And I tell them that on the first day of class, that, you know, I'm happy for them to bring their laptops in to look things up and use them as a participation device. But if they're not paying attention and I notice it and I call them on it, their grades are going to suffer. And that's, you know, in the Kelly family, we call this paying the stupid tax.
Well, I mean, there is a trend. You know, I just read about this somewhere else about I don't know if the two of you have heard about this, but they're called topless meetings, which it's a pretty funny name for, you know, no laptops in the meeting. And companies are doing this too. You know, they just say, you know, we're going to have a topless meeting, no laptops, no Blackberries, no iPhones. And but is that a different situation, the teaching situation? Is it something where, you know, business really, you know, can require their employees to kind of pay full attention and not be surfing the web or doing email or text messaging?
I think the problem here, I guess, is I think there are times in a class when you want to say to your students, okay, shut your laptops, or even particular classes. Courses, you know, a full semester where you say there will be no using laptops in this class. I can see why, you know, in a certain circumstance that a certain professor would want to do that, either on a class by class basis or for the semester. The problem here seems to be that it's a blanket policy. They're cutting off access to all classes, and I think that is this kind of reaction. If you read actually the email that the dean of the University of Chicago Law School, Saul Levmore, sent around to his faculty and students explaining the new policy, he actually, I'll quote something here. He says, "Several observers have reported that one student will visit a gossip site or shop for shoes, and within 20 minutes, an entire row is shoe shopping." you know, that seems like an overreaction to me. I'm sure that shoe shopping is not that contagious. That that entire classes at the University of Chicago Law School, which is, after all, one of the best law schools in the country, are spending all of their time shoe shopping in class. And I think that there are times and places for telling, allowing students to use their laptops and disallowing students to use their laptops. So I think it's the blanket nature of this policy that's the problem.
I mean, what I just don't get here is, aren't we moving more and more to applications that live on the web, that, you know, note-taking applications and all kinds of services that we use in academia that are, you know, as they say, in the cloud. They're out there on the internet. And so, you know, I just don't get how this works in the long run. I mean, it just...
Well, this is, I'm sorry, but this one really frosts me because, first of all, so what if they're shoe shopping? Okay, what does that say about the kind of instruction that's happening in that classroom? If, in fact, students at the University of Chicago Law School can do well in their classes and pass the bar and also shoe shop, either that instructor is fabulous because he or she is teaching in such a way that all of those things are possible, or that instructor is so deadly boring that the only way students can make it through an hour and 30 minutes or an hour and 15 minutes is by going shoe shopping or checking out the latest celebrity gossip. So it's, you know, it says something about the pedagogy that's in evident in that classroom, and I would have to go and see for myself. But, you know, about 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago now, I was sitting in on one of our adjunct faculty members here classes and observing her teaching and providing feedback. And I was sitting all the way in the back of the room, and there were 10 or 12 laptops open in the room. And most of the students were, in fact, just taking notes. Now, they would get an IM every once in a while, and they would, you know, type in two or three words to, you know, they'd respond for a second or two, but then they would go back to taking notes. There was one student, however, who was all over the internet. I could just see she was IMing, she was checking her email, she checked her bank account balance, she did all sorts of stuff. And I was thinking, okay, here's a student who's just not paying attention. And then she raised her hand and asked the best question that any student in the class had asked. She was a very bright young woman and had was staying connected to what was happening in the class while doing all these other things. I think what's happening at the University of Chicago Law School is that that these professors are feeling wounded in their vanity that students aren't paying attention. Well, get over yourself. You know, if they students choose to pay attention or not pay attention, whether there's a laptop there or not, and the question is, how are they performing in class, and what does that have to do with the way the class is being taught?
Well, that was quite an impassioned speech, and
I'll get off my high horse here.
Yeah. I'm sure you made some good points, Mills, but I was actually on the internet shopping for shoes.
Yeah, well, I know, but you know, it's you know, maybe our listeners don't know that your middle name is in fact Imelda, but.
Well, in the news roundup, Mills, you brought up Chris Anderson, the editor at Wired. He has a new book that's coming out, I guess, right now. It's just an article in Wired, but it's gotten a lot of press, and he's turning it into a book, and the book is simply entitled Free, and it's just about the way in which so much of what we see on the internet, by its very nature, will be reduced to a price of zero. And that this is just inevitable. It's the nature of the internet. And Mills, you've recently written a lot on your blog, edwired.org, about the coming Chris Anderson type world in academia and what free means for us. I guess maybe I want to toss out a challenge and a sort of question about that. And indeed, this featured segment, we're going to talk about, you know, how we can sustain digital projects, digital education, digital tools in academia. But isn't Chris Anderson, and indeed you've sort of thrown a wrench in this by saying, well, it is going to go to free. If that's the case, I mean, how do we live in this free world and still have some kind of model towards sustainability?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to note that Anderson isn't saying that everything becomes completely free, because then that sounds a little too much like Milo Minderbinder in Catch 22, where he's, you know, he's buying eggs for a dollar in Malta and selling them in Italy for 85 cents, but everybody has a share, so it's good for the company. it's not like that. Anderson proposes in this article a whole different series of models for a new free economy. So, for instance, the one I think has the most relevance for higher education is what he calls the cross-subsidy model, where essentially what I'm proposing is that we ought to just go ahead and give away the general education curriculum, because in many cases we do anyway. We allow students to transfer in from other institutions, especially community colleges, and we give them credit for all of that prior work that they've done that somebody else got the money for, not us, but we still credit them for that. And instead, we should go ahead and give them about a third of their college degree, about 40 credits worth, something like that, as a way of then inducing them to focus on the upper level courses. And at the same time, if they want, if they need other services from us, it's kind of like the Ryanair model, where you get the ticket from Dublin to Barcelona for $19, but if you want to bring luggage on, you have to pay an extra $5 per piece of luggage, and if you want a drink, you have to pay for that, and if you want extra legroom, you have to pay for that. Well, in our case, it's if you want instead to use the writing center, that costs money. If you want to use one of the student media labs, that there's some charge against your student account. So that if you want to, pay for premium services, you can, and those premium services cross-subsidize the free general education.
Huh. And so, the other model I'm thinking about here is the free nacho chips at Mexican restaurants, which makes you thirsty and you want beer. Is that the
right.
Is the general ed it's a loss leader then? Is that what you're saying in this model?
In some ways it can be a loss leader, but it can also there are other varieties of this model that can work in higher education. If you think of the Flickr model, where you get the basics for free and you can only upload so many photographs a month, or you pay $29.95 for the pro account and then you have unlimited uploads. Well, students could have the basic general education for free. They have to test out of these courses. They don't get to just walk in and get check marks next to their name for Western Civ or whatever. They actually have to test out of the courses. But then, if they want the pro model, then, if they want to participate in some sort of, freshman learning seminar or something like that, that costs extra. And so it's not even necessarily a lost leader. It's you can do the basics. If all you want for general education is just to kind of get through it, which we have to admit many students, that's all they want. But the students who have real intellectual curiosity and want to explore other topics on their own, well, they have to pay a little extra for that. And that's where scholarships come in to help discount it for students who can't afford to pay for that extra. It doesn't make financial aid go away.
Yeah, I can see university accountants ripping their hair out right now at the complexity of this model. I just isn't the model right now, it's so comprehensible, right? There's certain number of credit hours and, they cost X amount. It just seems like, the only other model that I can see that's similar to this that has had some success is the open courseware model, where MIT is, put out this massive material, but we just discussed the RIAA, and you think of the free model there is, what Madonna and some other stars have done, which is, they realize their music's going to be traded for free, and so instead of signing a contract with a record company, you sign it a contract with a tour promotion group, because you're making all your money on the live performances. And so in that way, for instance, MIT they're making the money on, the attractiveness of actually being able to sit in person with that star professor who's put all their stuff online for free. Is that different than what you're saying? You've got a more complicated model here.
Well, no, I think that's in many ways essentially what I'm saying. I think that there are a variety of different models that could be explored, and also I think there's something kind of wrong in what you said earlier, that it's a pretty straightforward model right now. In fact, every student on our campuses pays a different price. It's actually colleges and universities have an incredibly complex financial modeling system where, you know, each student has a different amount of financial aid or scholarship, and that's some of that's based on need, some of that's based on merit, some of it's based on the fact that we need more students to study Italian or play the trombone in the band. And so they have we have, in many ways, our model is much like the airlines model. Once the semester starts, if students aren't in the seats in our classrooms, that's money that we've lost and we can never recover. The airlines, it's the same. Once the plane takes off, the empty seats represent lost revenue. And so universities discount aggressively to try to fill all those seats because we're still going to heat the building. We're still going to pay the faculty members to teach the classes. We're still going to have campus security officers and all of those things, which we're stuck with. So we want students there because if they aren't there by September 15th, we've lost that revenue and we can never recover it. So we have this actual discounting model that means that nobody's paying the same price on campus.
Huh, that's a good point. Let me expand out this conversation about the free and the sustainable to include not only education but also digital tools and services of the kind that we discuss on the podcast quite regularly. Tom, you know, both of us are responsible for major software projects that put out free and open source software used by a lot of people. And, you know, we encounter this problem, right? I mean, we're we not only do we want to, but we are actually, we have to put out our materials based on our grants under a free and open license. But we're also, sort of charged with the need to come up with a sustainability model. What are your thoughts on this matter? How do we deal with not just the education side, but also resources, collections, online archives, online tools? To go with education, how do we make those sustainable for the long run if we're not getting paid for them?
Yeah, it's a very difficult problem. As you say, we're required to release our tools under open source licenses, and while we're not prohibited from exploring cost recovery models, I think we are encouraged to give at least some version of these things away for free. We're charged with providing free tools to students and scholars and researchers and teachers and others. And at the same time, the foundations and the government agencies who give us our support are understandably concerned that the money that they give to us and to other tool building institutions isn't squandered, that it lasts and that it has a long-term effect and is able to last beyond the life of the grant. And so we're faced with this dilemma. After the grant is over, how do you maintain these tools? When you're building digital tools, they require really constant upgrading and maintenance and user support and other things, and how to do that is problematic. And so with something like Omeka, we're exploring a bunch of different options. One of the things we're exploring is a model like you have with WordPress, where the server downloadable application is free, but if you want a hosted account on WordPress.com, you can get free accounts, but you can also pay for a monthly subscription if you want more features, more services, greater storage capacity, and other things. So we're exploring that with Omeka to have a hosted version where a kind of freemium model where you can get more services, more support, more storage if you're willing to pay for it. But there's always going to be a free version for nonprofits or for people running smaller projects or who don't need lots of support or services. So that's one model we've been exploring. There are others. One is an ad supported model. We've thought about that, although it's hard to see how that works in a educational context, scholarly context, both because the audiences are very small usually and because there's a certain, morality ethics surrounding advertising and education, and you don't want to mix the two. And other things like donation models is another thing we've been exploring. Is there enough of an audience, enough of a market for a kind of NPR-style donation model where you have a membership to the tool, and if you like it, you give money, and we'll have to have some kind of membership drive. So it is a very difficult problem to solve, and I don't think anybody's come up with any real good solutions yet.
Yeah, you know, I think there was a great post, and I'll link to this from digitalcampus.tv, a great post on the OpenCourseWare blog by Laura Dewis, who is, she is the sort of online communications person and media relations person for the Open University's Open Learn website. And she wrote a really eye-opening and sort of helpful blog post on called Money Makes the World Go Open, and in which he sort of goes over a bunch of the options that, Tom, you just spelled out for funding the free and making it sustainable. And so I'll just real quickly reel off some of the things you mentioned. But, you know, pre-financing from a foundation, sponsorships, subscriptions for extra services or fees for extra services. Mills, that sort of gets into what you were talking about. The freemium model where 1% of the users pay sort of extra and 99% of the users, you know, use a more basic version. So the people who really need kind of a high-end or larger version of something pay more or pay something, whereas most people who need a kind of restricted version get it for free. Private partnerships, donations by the community. And then this one that Tom, you mentioned, I sort of want to talk about just very briefly. I mean, advertising. Universities that want to have, let's say, an OpenCourseWare site, is it okay to put advertising on that site to make it sustainable?
I think in some cases it probably is okay, and I think in other cases it probably isn't. Especially since the way that the ads are placed, at least in today's world, is by search algorithms and by keywording and things. I think if let's say you're I'm just thinking of Omeka and online exhibitions in the museum world. If you're launching an online exhibition on, let's say, the Sand Creek Massacre in Colorado, and a battle between the U.S. Army and Native Americans, which is a very sensitive topic, a very controversial topic, something that has a long memory and where the wounds and the emotions are very raw. For that, I don't know if you want Google deciding what kinds of ads to place next to the content. I think you want to give visitors and your stakeholders an experience that's free from Google ads. So I think in some cases it may be okay. Maybe for a course website it may be okay, but I think for other kinds of websites or tools, it may not be. And I think that's a difficult question. It's certainly not a model I think that you can extend to all tools. And it may be that we need to come up with some hybrid, and it may be that for on a case-by-case basis you have to look at your tool and decide which of these models works best. I suppose that's the way it's going to shake out. But none of them seem like a silver bullet to me.
Mills, looking forward, do you think that this free will indeed gain traction in the university? Is this a way of doing what you were saying of a sort of price differentiation or slicing up the market so that they'll this will be effective?
Well, first of all, it's already happened. Isn't Princeton free?
Yeah, right.
So there's and I think but in addition to that, I think that I think we're going to see it instead of kind of from the top places like Princeton or Harvard who can afford to give away their education. I think we're going to see it from the bottom as well. But I think it's going to take a long time. I mean, we've talked about this before. Universities are incredibly conservative institutions and move incredibly slowly in the face of changes in the marketplace, but nevertheless they do. I think, you know, I think it's going to happen. I think it's just going to take a while.
And Tom, what do you see in the future for the people building tools and archives and museums and libraries who are putting things online? What do you think about this? You think there'll be a common sustainability model, or will it just be a amalgam of some of the things that Laura Dewis talks about?
I think it's going to be an amalgam of some of those things. I think I'm not sure if we know really any of these models are tested yet. So I think we're going to have to spend some time testing these models. And I imagine at each project is going to have to make its own decisions on which models are best for it. The other thing I would add to this is right now, the burden for sustainability, it's sort of assumed that the burden for sustainability falls solely on the grantee. It's almost as if at the end of the grant term, if it's a 2-year grant or a 3-year grant, that the foundation or the agency that's funding the project just assumes that they are out, that it's over, and that all the burden for sustainability, for long-term maintenance and sustainability, upgrades, etc., fall onto the grantee. I think that funding agencies and funding entities are going to have to work more closely with their grantees on sustainability in the future. I think that some of the burden is going to have to fall on the funders as well as the fundees. And I think at least until these questions are sorted out, some of the burden is going to have to fall back on the foundations and the agencies, something which they're not at all comfortable with and that they don't have the mechanisms in place to deal with, but neither do we. And I think if we're going to work this out, it needs to be a collaborative effort.
Great point. Well, if our audience has good examples of either free tools and resources that have come up with good sustainable models, or if you know of education projects of the kind that Mills was talking about that also have models for sustainability, let us know, of course, on our website, digitalcampus.tv. Time for picks of the week. Mills, why don't we start with you?
All right. Well, my pick of the week is actually an interesting pair of maps produced at the website World Mapper. I don't know if either of you have ever been to this website, but they display some geographers who display data proportionally on the globe so that countries get larger or smaller based on their values in the data table. And so these are two maps that they produced recently on internet users, one from 1990 and then the other from 2002. And it's really quite remarkable how the internet world has changed in that span of time. And so it really helps us to visualize the changes that have gone on in the digital world, where in 1990, almost all of the internet users were either in the United States or Western Europe, with just a few scattered around the globe. And now it's a much more evenly distributed phenomenon. And so I think that really has to change our thinking about what we're doing in digital work, because we're no longer just talking to ourselves. We're actually talking to people all around the world.
Great. Yeah, that's a really interesting site. And those maps are really, they are eye-opening and they look good. Tom, what do you have for us this week?
This week I've got the Harvard College Thesis Repository, which is a project headed mostly by students, which aims to get all of the Harvard College theses up online for free under Creative Commons licenses. And I got an email about this asking me to put my Harvard's my alma mater, and I got an email asking me to put my college thesis up online in this repository, which I haven't done yet, and it looks like not many of us have.
Really?
Right now they've got 25 theses available.
Huh.
And that may change. I'm thinking that may change this spring when Harvard ends a little later than most, and as seniors start to finish their theses, I'm hoping to see more of this. But I think this is a great idea and something that other schools, other undergraduates should consider. there's so much good undergraduate work done, and so little of it ever makes it into print or even online. I think this is at least one model for getting some of that great work up online, and I hope it succeeds. So I'd like people to check it out, and we'll put the URL in the show notes.
That's great. I've been meaning to check that out. A little disappointed there's only 25, but yeah, hopefully it'll be 26 soon. All right. Thanks, Tom. Well, I'd like to do my part to, this was this past week, included RSS Day, which was a day organized decentrally around the internet to try to get more people to understand what the heck RSS is and to use it more. And I think, you know, the three of us were used to seeing things pop up in Google Reader or whatever RSS reader we're using. And a lot of people who are sort of technically savvy and are using all these Web 2.0 services, and I assume this includes most of the audience here, because if you're using this podcast, you are using RSS to get the actual audio file via our RSS enclosure. But there's so many people out there who, you know, don't know what RSS is and how it can help their lives. And I think there's a great website that I'd like to promote just called rssday.org. It's the May 1st, it launched on RSS Awareness Day. And it just explains it in, you know, five sentences, what RSS is, has a little video, which is really terrific, and then shows you, you know, it actually, you know, how to subscribe to a feed, what the RSS icon looks like, where to look for it, in other words, in the location bar of your web browser, and then how to, you know, start using something like Bloglines or Google Reader. And it's just all on one page. It takes about 1 minute to read. I think they probably could have used better examples. Of course, this being set up by techies, they used Smashing Magazine and Mashable, two sort of tech/web design websites as their examples. I think it would have been better to use, you know, New York Times or you know, BBC as their screenshots. But nevertheless, I think it's a helpful, quick site that explains what RSS is, how it can help out people who currently aren't using it. And I think this is the kind of site that really helps out when there's a new technology and there's a real large mass of people. I mean, I know among historians, for instance, I would say over 90% of them won't know what RSS is. At least faculty. And so I think this is the kind of site that we could use for other sorts of technologies that sort of underlie Web 2.0 and a lot of things we discuss on this podcast. Again, at rssday.org. Well, thanks to our audience for joining us. Mills and Tom, thanks for the conversation. And we'll be back again in 2 weeks for another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Thank you.